You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everybody. It's my pleasure to welcome you, both those of you in the room and those watching on webcast, to this launch of the 2018 Aid Transparency Index. The hashtag for the event is hashtag 2018 Index. I'm doing a dual role today in that I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings and I chair the Friends of Publish What You Fund. Many of you have been engaged in the effort to make aid transparent for the better part of this decade, since it moved from a little known movement to being endorsed by most donors at the 2011 High-Level Forum in Busan. As background to the presentation and discussion today, it is useful to review why aid transparency. The answer is that data allows donors, governments, implementers to make better decisions, to identify what aid is needed, where and how to target it, and it supports better coordination, better analysis, and better evaluation. As articulated by the 2016 High-Level Panel Report on Humanitarian Finance, and while this quote is targeted at humanitarian, it applies to all assistance. The more we know about how money is channeled through the global system, the better equipped we are to allocate resources effectively and measure results. For donors to provide more flexible and predictable funding, they need reliable, real-time, prioritized, comparable, and open data on the needs that they are being asked to finance and the results produced by the funding. As we will hear from Kathy shortly about the new index, there has been good progress. But as we look ahead to the next decade and the ambitions of the Sustainable Development Goals, it is clear that we face some big challenges, including one, vastly greater need for finance, trillions, not billions, well beyond foreign assistance. Two, the magnitude of resources that are being directed to easing humanitarian suffering and the urgency to build resilience through bridging the humanitarian development divide. And thirdly, a vastly more diverse landscape, including more developing countries can now finance much of their own development, but they still need some external assistance, a broader array of donors, both public and private, and expanding development finance involving public-private collaboration, private investment funds, blended funds, pooled funds, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds. They have different models, different approaches, and different missions. We need to know what they are doing and how they can be harnessed, or at least guided, to produce better development. We need to encourage these additional investments, but we also need to maintain the transparency standards that we have worked so hard to instill. Without transparency, we will lack the tools to facilitate their working together, to help ensure effective use of resources, and to hold institutions accountable. Full transparency across the development finance arena means that we can see the whole picture, as you saw in the video, of who is financing what, for what purpose, and where. Having this information means that we can be smart about how we invest resources. There are still investments for which ODA is the best source of funding, such as establishing rules of law. And there are other areas, like job creation, where private or blended flows make more sense. Having the full picture helps avoid the gaps and the duplication that happens far too often when information is not shared. Accountability is particularly important where we have institutions whose mission may not be poverty reduction or even development. You will hear more about this in the panel discussion. How do we know whether investments are contributing to development outcomes if we lack information on the results? Transparency on its own will not solve our development challenges, but it will go a long way to contributing to better decision-making, better coordination, and hopefully better outcomes. As a preface to Catherine Turner, the interim CEO of Publish What You Fund, presenting on how 45 of the world's largest donors are doing and an introduction to the Aid Transparency Index, a recent academic analysis by Dan Honig and Catherine Weaver concluded that the index has attained and exercised significant symbolic and normative power by defining clear indicators and benchmarks for donor transparency. Its authority derives from its independence and its process of working with donors and external reviewers. Catherine?
Hello. Well, this is really an honour and a pleasure to be able to present the Aid Transparency Index results for 2018. But first of all, I'd like to thank Brookings for this wonderful venue and George Ingram and the board of Friends of Publish What You Fund for your support, our funders for their support, and of course the Publish What You Fund team who've been working tirelessly for months now to pull all of this together. But I wanted to start really with by sharing an experience of my own. It was quite a formative one that happened when I was new to Publish What You Fund. It was in my first few weeks in the job, and I was at a conference where I met a delegate from the finance ministry in Afghanistan. And being new, I wanted to ask lots of questions. What are the challenges? What does it look like for you? How do you think about transparency? And he outlined several problems that arise when you don't have transparency or it doesn't work well. He painted a picture of donors not coordinating their activities, leading to duplication and gaps. He also spoke how his government was not being consulted, so he didn't know how to allocate his own budgets. But most memorably, I remember him telling me about the first time that he knew one donor had commissioned a major construction project was when he looked out of his window and he saw the construction workers arriving to get started on it. True story. But this is just one story, and we do hear numerous others which tell us why transparency matters. But the situation today is far better than it was. We're pleased to say that aid and development transparency has come an incredibly long way in the last 10 years. Over the last decade, up-to-date information on projects, financial flows, and so on are more available than ever before. Now, 93% of the major aid donors that we look at publish at least some information in open and comparable formats, and around half of those we assess produce information on a monthly basis. So more current information is available than ever before. But there is still a job to do. Aid is changing. As we've heard, today we see a growing aid and development finance gap, which is estimated to be in the trillions globally every year. And as well as that, we have a growing diversity of actors stepping forward with new ways to mobilise finance and funding, such as development finance institutions, DFIs, the private sector, and pooled or trust funds, to name just a few. Humanitarian actors have made commitments to make their aid funding more transparent too. So this requires us to renew the call for greater aid transparency across the board. So how do things look in 2018? The results. So, we have to say congratulations to the Asian Development Bank, who come first this year. It really is an impressive feat and the result of commitment from the very top, dedicated resources and technical work across teams. And this year it's notable that many different types of agency do well. Not only did the Asian Development Bank come top, but DFIs dominate the very good category, accounting for 4 out of 7 agencies in it. We also have 2 bilateral agencies, UK DFID and USMCC, and also 1 UN agency, UNDP. Another type of agency to do well is EC ECHO, the EC's Directorate General for European Civil Protection and Humanitarian Aid Operations. It is in the good category, but one of the best EU performers, second only to DFID and ahead of its EC counterparts. Now, I already mentioned that that DFIs account for many in the very good category. It's worth looking a little bit closer at DFIs. And just to clarify that for the index, when we speak about DFIs, we are talking about multilateral development banks only, and seven of these are featured in the index. Now, all of them publish open and comparable information to the IATI standard, and six out of seven of these do so on a monthly basis, except World Bank's IDA, which does it quarterly. Now, not only did the Asian Development Bank come top, but collectively, DFIs outperform other organisations. But there are disparities, which prompts some interesting questions for the panel, perhaps. As you can see, within the DFIs group, organisations that work primarily with the private sector, World Bank, IFC and EBRD, perform relatively less well. Now, I'm going to say now, and not just because we have the IFC on the panel today, but the IFC began publishing to IATI only recently and has made really significant progress in the index since 2016. But also, echoing George's point, it would also be interesting to hear how DFIs measure their contribution to development outcomes when poverty reduction may not necessarily be their primary mandate. Another highlight of the results is that unprecedented amounts of information are available that are timely and in an accessible format. 75% of the agencies in the index publish monthly or quarterly, and 50% monthly, which is double what was the case in 2016. And only 3 out of 45 agencies, the 3 at the bottom, do not publish information in the IATI standard. But this is compared with only one donor who published to IATI in January 2011. So there is a lot to feel positive about. But, there's always a but. Too many agencies aren't getting the basics right. More information doesn't necessarily mean better information. For example, over 25% of agencies do not provide project descriptions, or the titles or descriptions they give cannot be understood by non-experts. This is a real example of a title published by a major donor found on dPortal, which, as you can see, it's present. There's a title. But I might suggest it's unusable, meaningless, certainly to me, if I was looking at it. Another issue is that not all organisations regularly update their information or provide accurate dates. Don't know if anyone spotted. Because as you can see, the planned end date for this project is 2107. Now, I know that the path to self-reliance is a tough one, but this kind of leaves us without any hope whatsoever. But jokes aside, this actually happens repeatedly and makes data use all the more difficult. Now, we measure aid transparency according to components. And there are 5 components that we look at. And as you can see, donors perform well on average in most areas. But you can also see that one component at the bottom, the red one, needs improvement across a range of donors, and that's performance. And by performance, we mean the sharing of results, reviews, and evaluations, things like that, which help assess whether projects are progressing towards or have achieved their development objectives. And this is the area which has the most gaps. Collectively, donors score only 27% on average. This is why it matters. This information is important as it enables donors, partner country governments, and civil society to monitor projects and for us all to learn from them. Finally, another low light is that some major donors are simply not pulling their weight. I mentioned that 3 organisations do not publish to IATI, but they also do not make their information readily available publicly elsewhere either. And while some organisations have greatly improved this time around, others are publishing to fewer indicators or less frequently than they did in 2016. So, in 2018, we have a mixed picture. We have seen some impressive gains, but also more work to do, especially getting the basics right and the need to provide more performance-related information. We also have to take account of an increasingly complex aid and development finance landscape. diverse funding streams present fresh opportunities for channeling aid and development finance, but also fresh demands for donors to open these up. It is also high time to move beyond publication of the data alone so that it can be accessed and used for better development outcomes. We all have a part to play, and for our part at Publish What We Fund, data use is one of the areas that we are prioritising in our new strategy. But for donors, we urge you, for example, to encourage and engage directly with your users to get direct and helpful feedback on your aid and development activities, and take feedback to improve the usability of that information further. Anyway, that's enough from me. I now really look forward to hearing the panel discussion about the changing aid and development landscape and what that means for transparency. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. If the panelists would come up while I introduce the moderator, you will notice from that presentation something that I learned 2 days ago when I read the report, and that it turns out that the Europeans and Americans use the term DFI differently, and we use it principally to refer to OPIC and its sister organizations and that type of public-private finance, where they use it to apply to multilateral banks, too. So we'll let Paul sort through that. My job here is simply to introduce Paul as the moderator. He's vice president for policy and campaigns at Oxfam America. He was a unanimous choice as the moderator for this panel because he's a member of the board of Friends of Publish What You Fund. He's a member of an organization that is committed, Oxfam America, to IOTI, so he knows the ins and outs, the easy part and the hard part. But mostly because Paul is an accomplished moderator who has an analytic mind that goes to the big picture and to the trends, and he can combine being provocative with being respectful that leads to a very interesting and engaging conversation. So thank you, Paul.
Thank you, George, for that wonderful setup.
and you have to live up to it.
And kind thoughts, yeah, don't worry, I know. So it's great to see everybody here, and thanks, Catherine, for the great presentation. It's great to see the launch. And it's super to see a packed house, so many of you taking time to be here with us today. This is important stuff. Just a couple of logistics before I say a word on why, but if you want to ask a question, and we're going to make time at the end for you to do so, we'll talk a little bit about how we'd like you to ask them, but we also have a live webcast, so if you're out there and you'd like to send a tweet to Aid Transparency, we'll try to get some of those in. So let me just say one word before I introduce our great panel. Why are we here? Why is this important? You saw the results. China and the United Arab Emirates are not sitting on the bottom of that index because they are unsophisticated about the power of information. You can't go to a sports stadium in this town without running into branding from the United Arab Emirates. They understand it. The Department of Defense is not the worst agency in the United States government on transparency because it doesn't have the resources to do it right. This is about political will. It's about a decision to use transparency. As George said, it's never going to be sufficient to solve the problems of the world. But tell me one great thing that we are collectively trying to do on World Refugee Day for people living and working on our borders and for people who are being separated from their families on our borders. Tell me anything we're trying to do these days if you don't have information about what's going on. So we're here to talk about the power of information to be used for good. And I am very honored to be with a professionally diverse group of people who are going to give you some great thoughts on that, and you're going to hear less from me from now on. So, introductions. Let's start with Tessie. Tessie is at the far left. Dr. Tessie San Martin is currently the president and CEO of Plan International USA, a children's rights organization focused on promoting gender equality and ensuring every girl fulfills her potential. She worked at the World Bank for many years as a director. She was a partner at IBM Consulting Services. Her doctor is in political economy from Harvard. And she has been a leader in our community, tying the theoretical to the practical and getting an institution to actually live those values for years. So it's just fabulous for certainly for me and for all of us, I think, to have a chance to hear her thoughts. Joel Charney, I'm going to do it in this order because I have it in the bio. Joel Charney here beside me, known for many years and has been a leader in the humanitarian community. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about what's particularly important when you think of humanitarian crisis. He is the director of Norwegian Refugee Council USA, provides overall leadership for that organization, which is very focused on advocacy and bringing in the resources to do so. Before that, he was a leader on humanitarian policy for our entire community at Interaction, where he was the VP there, and has had a range of positions with Refugees International, and actually worked for Oxfam for longer than I have. I've learned so much from Joel over the years, as have so many others of us. Principled, honest, very provocative, and likely to challenge all of us and all of you today. Katie Kaufman, who I had the pleasure to meet by phone yesterday and in person today and have heard about. We're so delighted that you're here. You're currently the Managing Director of Global Women's Issues at OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, where she leads OPIC's 2X Women's Initiative. We'll ask a little bit about that. Previously a founding partner at Magellan Ventures and a defense policymaker in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, where she also served in the United States Embassy in Beijing. So I've managed to comment already on two of her past institutions, both in the Foreign Commercial Service Office and in the Ambassador's Office. Feel free, you have a right of response. And also helped to make sure that the United States showed up well in the 2008 Summer Olympic Games, which I won't be asking about, but I was very impressed with. And last, and definitely not least, very happy to see Aaron Rosenberg here. We had a great conversation yesterday and plays a key role at the International Finance Corporation, which sits at the nexus of many of the things we're going to be talking about today. He is the Chief of Public Affairs there. He's responsible for managing the IFC's policy communications and engagement with key stakeholders, and manages and advises on corporate reputational risk and other strategic communications issues. He also worked in the U.S. government as its Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Representative, and has a very illustrious academic credentials as well, with masters from in public policy from the College of William and Mary in Virginia. So we are just delighted, professionally diverse group of folks who have strong views on these issues and are committed to giving you crisp commentary so that we can have a dialogue. Tessie,
yeah,
going to start with you.
Okay.
So you heard George's articulation of the why. You've seen the results from this year's index. What do you think are going to be the main challenges in delivering this vision as we seek to crowd in these new resources? And maybe if you could say a word about the particular challenges with these new flows, private sector flows and domestic resources of governments, while we're trying to raise standards at the same time.
Yeah. So good question. I think we'll set up the conversation nicely. So there are many, but let me just say three because they're easier to remember. I think the first one is what I would call, you know, the potential for IATI fatigue. And here I'll speak personally. So we're all committed to transparency, but we can suffer from IATI fatigue. And here, you know, I'll just give the example of my, you know, own organization. I came in, you know, 7 years ago, super excited. We're going to just, you know, start publishing to the index. This is really cool. We're all in it. And, you know, and I'm the CEO, so I can do something about it. Well, so we are publishing to IATI. We, you know, but it's kind of like the myth of Sisyphus, right? You, like, roll up the rock and it rolls back down because, you know, the reality, the sheer drudgery of, you know, how you, you know, of using, you know, legacy systems that are clunky and are not meant to collect information in a, you know, in a easy manner, and it all has to be manual, and then the person that you had as the champion, she leaves, and then you have to train somebody else, and on and on and on. And so the secret to all of this, and we had a good conversation with some of the U.S. agencies yesterday, I think is to work on the demand side, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. I'll just mention one very clever thing that I saw that we heard from MCC in doing is, so they're using Google Analytics, right, to better understand who's using their data and for what purposes and so on. That's brilliant, right? Because then that motivates the staff, you know, why am I doing this? Is this the upload to nowhere or is there a purpose, right? So that's number one, right? We need to be able to energize it because just simply being psyched about transparency is not enough, believe me. The second aspect, and you've mentioned it, so that George, I mean, that little video we had at the beginning. So listen, IATI, you know, we're all here celebrating 10 years. This is great. And 10 years ago, if we could get all the major, you know, bilateral, multilateral donors publishing to IATI, then we'd really be able to capture the information, have a really good idea of what was going on. Well, that's since gone by the wayside, right? You know, ODA is now a small fraction of what's actually going on, of FDI and public equity and loans and, you know, philanthropists and, you know, private, INGOs like ourselves. And none of that is actually being captured. So if the majority of what's going on is not being captured, is IATI really relevant? What is it telling us? And by the way, all these new entities, are they equally committed to transparency? I actually think that the answer to that is not necessarily no. It's possibly very much, you know, an enthusiastic yes. But there again, there's a difference between being committed to IATI, to transparency, and then going through the IATI thing, right? And so, we need to think about sort of what are the interfaces that make that whole sort of IATI publication easier. But private entities, and particularly, you know, commercial ones, because people, and, you know, Aaron, maybe you can comment on this, but, you know, there's a sense that, you know, well, they're all very worried about commercial secrets. They don't want to go out there and, you know, share any information. But I think that's a little not quite true. You know, wearing my private sector hat, which I wore for many years, you do want to know what's going on out there because so that you can better leverage your resources. There can be real buy-in into the transparency agenda. And here I'm going to channel you, Paul, is, data is political, isn't it? And decisions about, you know, how data is are collected, what data are collected, you know, how are they aggregated, what are we looking at, are all very political. And the reason I say this is because we have some really pretty big gaps in data. And gender, since you're here with us, Katie, is one big one that Plan is certainly very concerned about. As people, you know, ourselves and you and I, Paul, are in the board of Friends of Publish What You Fund, so we care deeply about IATI. So how is IATI contributing to addressing these big data gaps? Because in an era of, you know, these humanitarian crises, a lot of displaced people, a growing inequality, if the data transparency movement is not addressing these data gaps, then this too could eventually lead to the irrelevancy of IATI as part of the transparency movement. So I'll leave it there.
Thanks, Tessie. Great setup. If you heard anything you really agree with or disagree with, the hashtag is up there, and we've mentioned it before. It's not
only
hashtag
agreement.
Yes. Yeah. Only agreement. Yeah. No hashtag IATI fatigue or hashtag the upload to nowhere. Okay. Be judicious. Okay. Aaron and Katie, I think we will get into the gender conversation a little bit, if we could, with you a little later, if that's possible. I think that's a great signal, and you've real expertise there. Aaron, to you next, if I may. You sit at the sweet spot that everybody's now talking about, where international investment crowds in this private sector funding, crowds in public funding. And at the same time as trying to get to that level of commitment and investment, the IFC has been a leader in trying to raise standards so that they don't just show up, but they show up in the right ways. Is that an easy set of tensions to manage at the IFC? How's it going? And particularly on the transparency front.
Short answer is no. It's not easy. But first, thank you for the question. Thank you all for having me today. I'm glad to be here. And thanks to the partnership with Publish What You Fund we've had the last several years has been really fruitful, I think, for us. And we're happy that our ranking has certainly improved, although we have to find we and others probably have a long way to go. But that said, let me start by first putting some context. I think you mentioned this, but also George really started with the fact that the world is changing. ODA is about $135 billion, maybe a little bit more or less, I think, depending on the year. The needs to finance the SDGs are $7 trillion. Huge, enormous gap. Where do you think the rest of that money is coming from? It's not going to be from the public sector. It is going to be from the private sector primarily, if not all. And so what does that look like? You know, it's a very different world than we have been in for the last 20 years. And what I would say is this is where I think, and I'll be the tempest, the index gets it wrong. It's set out from a primarily public sector viewpoint that doesn't apply to 90% of what development flows look like or are going to look like in the coming years. So if organizations like mine can only ever get to fair, what does that tell you? I think we need to be thinking about ways to encourage more private sector participation. And it's not, I agree with you, it isn't that transparency is this taboo word in the private sector. In fact, the opposite. Most companies have many reporting requirements that governments don't have. Or certainly can be complementary. And I think if we want to get a better picture of what the true development flows are, we need to be thinking about ways to be a little bit more pragmatic. So I'll give you from my own personal example. Somebody asked me recently, why did you join IADI? And I said, I'm going to be honest with you. There are a couple reasons why. Politics is number one. But the second thing, I said, first, when I first heard about IADI, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I said, what is that? International Aid Transparency Initiative. We don't do aid at IFC. That's not what we do. We do development, absolutely. That's our mission. But we don't do aid. And so if I'm saying that, imagine what a company who is arguably contributing to development many ways, how they might think about it. So I think the incentive system has to change. And so why did we join IADI? We worked with IADI for a period of years to really modify the standard to incorporate more aspects of what it is like to do business in the private sector. The timelines are very different. The business cycle is different. Some of the things that businesses are measuring, government is not measuring. Some things that government will put out, budgets, for example, the private sector is not going to do that. And I would say in many cases, it's not the most important thing. So if you're penalizing in the standard already, we're never going to get there. My CEO told me, okay, I'm really glad your ranking went up, get to number one. And my response is, that's never going to happen. And I hope that you're not, you know, giving me my performance rating based on that. So I think the time is changing, and we need to change with it. And I would like to see the index change as well. Last point on this, I think there is great opportunity in the SDGs. Many companies are already thinking about how they're going to report their contribution to the SDGs. In the last UNGA, in September of last year, I was at a panel with that we put together in the extractive space. And one particular company said, you know, we're excited about the SDGs because it's for the first time we can see how we can contribute to development. Right there is an opportunity. And so I think if we can think about ways to harness the data that companies will be putting in, reporting, and there are several initiatives already going on to figure out how companies can report in a common framework towards the SDGs, we need to be looking at that. Because the motivation is there. And we ourselves are reporting our results to the SDGs for the first time in our annual report this fall. So I would say let's think about being pragmatic in ways we can get the private sector to be reporting more and maybe include in the index in future years.
That's great. Thank you. And Katie, I see you nodding. So I'd be interested to...
I didn't steal your point.
I assume that IATI is perfect for OPIC and you don't need it to change at all and we can just have a debate between the two of you. But let me ask you more seriously this. This is such an important moment and it's great to have you here. OPIC is potentially going to grow to an entirely new scale. Some folks are talking about its portfolio doubling in the next short period. You've got Congress paying attention to you in hopefully a good way with the Build Act, proposing to create a new development finance institution growing out of OPIC, so it will be the new OPIC. And the same set of pressures from the U.S. Perspective applies to you. You're trying to crowd in where the real money is, as Aaron says, but you're also trying to be a standard setter and do the best of American good practice. And that's not always easy as you try to do that, particularly if you've got institutions in the mix like the private sector who, and we can debate, have different views about the importance of transparency in the field. So how is that going? Ray Washburn said he's committed, that's the new CEO of OPIC, he's committed to getting this right on both standards and growth. How easy is it going to be for you on the U.S. side, and what are you thinking about?
I think it's going to be really easy, unlike my other panelists. Well, I actually want to take a second to appreciate that question. When I took this job 6-7 months ago, OPIC was zeroed out in the president's budget. And I just got a question about what we're going to do now that we're doubling in size. So what caused that change in such a short period of time? I'll argue that one of the points is our commitment to transparency and best practices. So first, we have a new CEO. He's amazing. You should always, when you're speaking publicly, talk about how amazing your CEO is. Our CEO is amazing, and he has done a great job transitioning from zeroed out to educating people on what OPIC is and the tools that we have to offer. Two, as everyone else has mentioned, the world is changing, and OPIC mobilizes 3 private sector dollars for every dollar we invest. So moving from billions to trillions is something that we're committed to. But 3, the fact that we are committed to best practices, the very top of that being transparency, we're positioning ourselves to be a counter to someone like that doesn't engage in those best practices, for example, China. Right, so they're dumping trillions of dollars into markets where we also invest, and it's really important that the United States is holding up our best practices, particularly transparency. And I think that very point is what has moved both Congress and the executive branch, hopefully the public, to really feel like a development finance institution, something like OPIC, which previously thought was an oil cartel, to now be a major tool of U.S. foreign policy. So. I hope that answered your question.
Yes, great. Thank you. And I'm sure it's provoked some thoughts and questions from others. So thanks, Katie. Joel, over to you. And we're going to switch gears a little here because this is a really important perspective, particularly on World Refugee Day to bring into the room. All of this work to try and make the flows more transparent have a particular dimension in the humanitarian space, in crisis response. Do you think that the trends and efforts that you're hearing about in making aid flows more transparent have particular challenges, or there are particularly important opportunities when you think about humanitarian response, Jill?
Yeah, thanks, Paul, and thanks for including a humanitarian voice in this group. I want to take the temperature of the audience before I answer. The grand bargain... How many of you know what the grand bargain is or have ever heard of it? Please raise your hand. Okay, so I'd say more than half. Yeah. That's good.
Are you sure that their concept is the same as yours?
Yeah. We'll find out.
This is not Walmart's big deal.
Exactly, or this is not some great scheme by our president to advance his latest objectives. No, the grand bargain came out of the World Humanitarian Summit in 2016. And it's arguably the one thing that has the potential to have a significant impact that did come out of that massive global process. And the number one, the overall idea is to not only increase the amount of money that's available for humanitarian response, but to use the money that we have better. And the number one component of the grand bargain is transparency. But what I'm going to argue from a perspective of Norwegian Refugee Council is transparency in and of itself is not transformative. And if you look at the grand bargain, and I'm going to run through these really quickly, Paul, I promise, not explaining them. There are 10 interlocking things that we need together to make a difference, including transparency. Local responders, more support for local. Cash, use cash more, not delivering stuff. Reduce management costs, critical to Norwegian Refugee Council. We've got to be more efficient. Joint impartial needs assessments. So let's be transparent, but let's make sure we're being transparent about the right thing, i.e., what are the problems? If we don't have a common agreement on what the problems are, how are we going to get anywhere? Local participation, multi-year funding, reductions in earmarking, harmonizing reporting, and finally linking humanitarian and development efforts depending on the context. So the way I look at this fundamentally is there's an internal aspect and an external one. On the internal aspect, sure, NRC is reporting to IATI. We're happy to do that. We're committed to it. But we're still stuck in a system where we're reporting in multiple different ways to multiple donors, which is just not only time-consuming, but incredibly expensive. So sure, we can brag and say we're totally committed to IATI and we're doing the reporting that we need to do, but our staff, frankly, thinks it's a burden, you know, because we've got to report to the financial track, you know. So the Dutch and the and DFID say you must report to IATI. The Swedes say you must report to the, you know, financial tracking service. You know, Ofta until very recently was insisting on quarterly reports. So my point is that if we're going to be effective in the transparency realm, we need other things to happen that are mutually reinforcing. And then the final point I'll make, and Paul, we you know, I mean, the one thing I learned at Oxfam, and I'm so happy I started my career at Oxfam, is that power matters. And if you're transparent, but the people who matter don't actually have the power to access the information, or don't have the power to actually influence what we're going to do with that information, you could argue that we're just talking to ourselves. Yeah. You know, we're building, you know, by being transparent, yeah, it'd be cool to be rated on that index, and maybe if there were an NGO rating, you know, NRC would be number 4 and we'd be all happy. That helps us. Does that fundamentally help the people that we're trying to assist, the people that we're trying to empower even through our humanitarian work? So, I mean, I just feel a lot of the post-World Humanitarian Summit debate is very much focused on technical solutions, which, as challenging as they are frankly easy compared to the political, ideological, and power obstacles that we face in really changing the way humanitarian work functions.
Thanks for that, Joel. That's great. And it does make me think, if there's something that I think we all feel, many of us feel at least, that this year has been transformative in terms of power, it's the voice that women have brought to issues of power this year and to the equations of power that they are facing in the worst of crises, but also in this country in many different contexts. So, Katie, I want to put you on the spot a little bit because you're a leading voice in an important institution on gender. You've got an initiative called the 2X Initiative, and
yes,
it would be nice to hear a little bit about that. But How do you both capitalize on the moment of this waking up that I think many of us are witnessing around gender and the commitment to be more transparent and standard setting more generally? And is there any relationship between the two?
Okay, so I hope I was crisp on my first answer,
you
and
were.
I'm going to take some airtime.
There you go. There you go.
Okay, thank you. So for the first time ever, OPIC has been around since 1971, and for the first time ever, we have decided to explicitly call out empowering women as one of our core objectives. Our CEO has named it his top priority. When he hired me to take this job, he said, I want you to – he's from Texas – I want you to do this women's initiative, just to help the women. And we were excited. You know, he's so committed to it. And I was so excited about it. And we basically talked through the correlation between OPIC's mission, which is to support private sector growth, and how everything we do has to have two things. We have to have economic prosperity and support global stability, and women are key, absolutely key, if those are your two core objectives. So we took that back and said, okay, what does that mean? How are we going to empower women around the world? And we decided it meant everything. So we branded it as 2X so that we would not have another acronym in this town, and also the female chromosome and the fact that we're catalyzing private capital. So at least for every dollar we put in, we want two private sector dollars for women. And then we put a target number out the door. So we said we're going to invest $1 billion, mobilize $1 billion to support women around the world. It's the single largest financing commitment the United States government has ever made to global women's economic empowerment. So it's a really big commitment, a really big capital commitment. And then we said, well, that's not enough because we put out $4 billion every year. And women make up 50% of the population. So we need to make sure that every dollar we invest, whether it's to a microfinance institution or a large infrastructure project, has a gender lens consideration. And that means that our investment officers, which are talented investment bankers, have recognized, bought into, and understand there are certain gender patterns that have implications for better financial returns. So we're just saying as an institution, we're going to be better investors because we're going to understand women and the patterns that come with that, which is really exciting and sort of cutting edge. And then the final thing that we did is as we were pitching this, I was pitching it to the OPIC board on like my second week on the job, and it was an all-male board except for one woman who was rolling off. And that didn't sit well with me. And I said, we're actually going to flip this mirror on ourselves. And we are, I don't know if anyone's ever heard of EDGE certification, but like a building can get LEED certified. You can get EDGE certification, which is an international standard to make sure that your enterprise understands equality. So we'll be the first U.S. government agency to do that. And we hope that the rest of our institutions follow suit. So that's the 2X. Then we said, okay, well, what does that $1 billion going to go to? Is it women-owned enterprises? Is it women in management? Is it access to clean water, which affects hundreds of millions of women around the world? And again, we decided it includes everything. And we looked to what does it mean to be women-owned? And we looked to IFC, and they have a definition. We're like, okay, we'll use that. We want to harmonize. But the truth is there is nothing out there that really describes all of this. So we created it. And OPIC has put forward this criteria. We call it 2X criteria. Now getting to transparency, and then I'll wrap up really quick. There was a shining light at the G7 that I am sure none of you read about. Has anyone ever heard of the Ice Bucket Challenge?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was like when I was just out of college. I was very impacted by the Ice Bucket Challenge. I loved it. That guy who started it went to my university. So anyway, I decided we would do the 2X challenge, and we challenged all of our G7 counterparts to take the 2X challenge, and they did. For the first time ever, every G7 DFI committed to mobilize $3 billion toward a common aim, which is women's economic empowerment. And the only way that we're going to make it work is by being transparent. We have a website. We are putting everything on the website. How much money is going to these projects? By which institution? How much is private sector? Where is their public funds? And how is it that this project was categorized as a 2X project? Because if they're all women-owned, maybe our criteria is not right. And we have set up a group that is going to constantly be looking back and saying, are our interventions working, and publishing that, and holding each other accountable in a new and transparent way that I think is really exciting for development as a standard, and more importantly, for my heart, for women around the world. That's sorry, fantastic. Took a lot of airtime. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Great, inspiring. I am going to take us to some of the more sober dimensions of the challenges we face with gender and ask Joel a question. This has been a tough year on humanitarianism, gender, and transparency and run respect. In humanitarian crisis, you're introducing precious resources into resource-starved environments with communities who are on the wrong end of a power asymmetry. And this has led, I think many of you know, if you haven't, just get online, but it's led to big challenges for organizations like Oxfam and others in terms of what can happen when you have that much power and you're engaging on issues where some of that power disparity is also gendered. It's a deeply shameful part of what will now be our history. But it does, we have to ask the bigger question. What can we do to make sure these kinds of things don't happen again? And is transparency related to how we can make sure we are addressing these power asymmetries in humanitarian crises, Joel?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot that can be done and that is being done. I'm not sure how much of it actually relates to transparency in the sense that we need to fundamentally address the power imbalance that Paul alluded to. In the meantime, I think it's just there are a lot of very simple things we can do related, frankly, to having more women staff, more staff at local level who are women who are making those decisions. I also think we just need to be way better at being sensitive to and building on the community structures that already exist, and if they don't exist, find ways to support them. So I think the transparency thing comes in just related to our own overall accountability in terms of how we're using resources. But as long as this will not change, in my opinion, fundamentally, as long, and you guys have a campaign on this, as long as fundamentally humanitarian action is parachuting in with experts and stuff, and we have all the resources, and the community is put in the position of, in essence, begging us for resources, this dynamic will not change. And I think that's the fundamental issue that we need to address. You know, sure, transparency is part of that in the sense of being open about the way we're working, being open about our staff numbers and what the gender balance is, you know, being open about you know, how much of our resources are really going towards women empowerment, and more importantly, there's a whole thing we haven't talked about yet, actually, in the humanitarian arena of account. Of course, we have an awful jargon term called accountability to affected populations. But what it fundamentally means is, are we in any way responsible to or accountable to the people that we're actually trying to assist? And I think their transparency and information flow is absolutely vital. People need to have a way to judge our overall effectiveness. And if they're upset about what they see, they need to have a way to communicate that. And I think that's something that we're all working on in terms of, you know, trying to, whether, again, I insist, there's a technical aspect to that, and there's also an ideological aspect.
That's great. And it does remind me, Aaron, I'm going to you, and then we'll close with Tessie, and I hope you're getting ready with your questions, although we may even already have some that have come from some of our partners, so we'll try and fit them in too. Aaron, You said earlier on, I thought it was helpful, not an aid institution, but a development institution. You wake up with a mission that's different from some of the folks you're trying to influence, the private sector and governments. How do you use that role of leveraging your influence with these other two sets of actors when they don't necessarily wake up every day with the same goal in mind?
Sure, no, it's a good question. Just really quick, I wanted to say we are EDGE certified, so I'm happy about that.
Yeah.
And you mentioned something in one of your answers earlier that sparked in my head, that you wish there was an NGO category in the index, and I wish there was a private sector category
okay, there you go.
So we can relate on that.
Yeah.
Right. That might be the answer, truthfully.
Yeah.
It's a good question. And I view transparency as an outcome, but also a process. It's been one for us, and I think it is for many companies. The key is about finding things in common and being pragmatic, right? So as a development institution, we have a job to do, really, in setting a standard, we feel, among private sector operations in the development space. We do that in a couple ways. One is joining IATI in and of itself sends a particular signal, and working with them to adapt the standard to reflect the way the private sector works is one way, and so we hope to see more involvement there. Another is then the standards that we set ourselves, and much like what we've done in the environment, social, and governance space, our own standards have become a benchmark, in essence, for project finance in the development space globally. What we're doing now is to take that and try to broaden it, right, beyond the reach of our own operations to capital markets. So getting regulators, stock exchanges to look at IFC's performance standards as a benchmark to incorporate in their own ratings tools or certification schemes or whatever. And that's something we feel that we can expand the reach of what we do. Likewise, in the transparency space, we would like to see both not just our clients do what we're trying to do, but beyond that. And so we developed an ESG disclosure toolkit that we rolled out, Environment, Social, and Governance, which is really a guide for both our clients and companies on reporting in the sustainability space, not just to only meet our own requirements, but broader than that. Mm-hmm. So it's piggybacking off things, mm-hmm. global movements, et cetera, and then trying to shape markets beyond just our own, the scope of what we do. That is, I think, how we can use our influence, which is evolving too. I mean, our own thought has evolved in a lot of spaces. Half our business now is done through financial institutions, and we're trying to impose our transparency standards on them as well. But it's a process, and I think it takes time. People operate under this myth that a lot of companies are, you know, totally secretive and they don't want to put out any information. Totally not true. Many companies put out information, but it's for, like, as you said, a different reason. Their motivation might be different. Mm-hmm. They could be trying to raise money themselves, or they might have reporting requirements to regulators, credit agencies, or what have you. And the confluence, though, is really interesting because a lot of these things are overlapping. A lot of the things on performance, particularly, are things that these agencies want to know as well. So I think the more to which we can adapt and take those and capture that, the more transparent we'll be, really, and we'll have access to a lot more information to inform decision making.
That's great. Thank you. Tessie, bring us home. So I'm looking out at the room here, and I am seeing a community of many of them civil society actors, many friends here. But also I see some folks from the U.S. government that you've been engaging with these past days on these issues. So it's a little bit of a two-pronged question. What do you think we as a community can and should be doing in light of this conversation we've had today, in light of the both the challenges and opportunities in transparency? And do you have any reflection on the engagement with the U.S. government over these past couple of days and how you think they're going? USAID, probably the biggest story in this year's index, trending significantly upwards. Others pretty much staying where they were. Any thought on that, too, before we open it up?
Yeah, you did sneak that last question. Okay,
I did sneak it in.
Yeah, I got some opinions. So actually this panel has been great and actually moved well beyond just IATI to really talk about the broader transparency agenda, and I think has given us a lot of food for thought. And so as I reflect on it, just a few maybe to-dos for all of us. I don't have necessarily the solutions for them, but what might we take away from it? One is, for me, IATI was created with a certain type of world that existed then, and we need to be thinking about how that gets modernized to reflect the world that we're living in now. And the great thing, and we've heard from two organizations that are really on the edge, and have been really thinking about these issues. So, how do we create effective and viable partnerships between all of these institutions that are working in different parts of the aid agenda to really create a more robust, reporting tool? Because at the end of the day, though IATI is not the end all or be all, it is, for me, hard to imagine how we create a lot of sustainability and momentum around the transparency agenda without having a robust tool, which is what IATI has provided. And so then that leads me to, so what else should we be doing? And here I'll go back to some of the things I said at the beginning, which were echoed here again. We do need to work on the demand side of it. We need better, examples, actually, and better information about how the data itself is being used, some case studies on that. Public Budget Fund did a really nice set of case studies that demonstrated how you can use the data that are available in IATI to answer important policy questions, including, in this case, so what happens when, the U.S. foreign assistance budget is cut drastically in a number of countries? And if you haven't seen the case studies, I do urge you to go to the Public Budget Fund website and download them. They are enlightening. And we couldn't have done those case studies if we didn't have the data. So it can be an essential instrument for having evidence-based, amazing, policy decisions. So that's another aspect. The other one, I'll go back, and we've seen it here in this discussion, the whole issue of, of data gaps, and in particular around gender. It's not the only data gap that exists, but it is a really important one, and it is, I think, urgent to address it. In PLAN, we've been, very involved in creating a tracker to track, along with a variety of other partners, to track progress on the, SDG 5 and, gender equality. And what we have found is just how little data exists, of, 14 indicators that are supposed to be tracked. Only about 3 of them have any kind of, methodology behind them. While there is more data on women and girls between the ages of 15 and 49, there is almost no credible data on girls under the age of 15, for example. So we need to, work on these issues. And then, Joel, I just loved your comment that transparency is not in and of itself transformative. So there are data is out there, but so what if you can't access it or you don't know how to use it? One of the things that we've been involved in at PLAN, and I think more of that needs to be done, is using data, in particular the data that is coming out of the tracker that we're developing on gender equality, to work with groups of, in our case, young people and civil society in the countries where we work to enhance and support their efforts to build their capacity to use that data for effective advocacy. Just because you've got data out there doesn't mean that you're going to have effective advocacy. And it's a skill set like any other. So really, building civil society capacity in this regard of using the data and using the data effectively for advocacy is very important. And I'll say one more thing. In previous versions of this launch event, you know, so we published to IATI, Jill's organization published to IATI. In the U.S., most civil society organizations do not publish to IATI. There's no requirement that that be done. And I think that there should be. And I think that, you know, USAID should make it a requirement because it's about getting, you know, more information out there. And sometimes, you know, just having somebody to tell you to do it, to your point, you know, makes a makes a difference. Yeah. Now, here's the deal, though, and this is the last thing I'll say. And this goes back to Joel's comment about the requirement. If you do that, then I would say take a page from the DFID book, because I think that DFID was very clever. They said, yeah, you know, we want everybody reporting, but we're just going to have one portal, right? One reporting function. And when you report into that portal, you're reporting into DFID, right, and you're reporting into IATI. Because if there's a requirement to now report to IATI, but that is on top of everything else, then all you're doing, honestly, is increasing NICRA, for those of you who deal with the U.S. government, right? Because then at that point, you've just increased, you know, compliance burden. And that's just not good. So I'll leave.
That's great. Thank you. So we've got to that fun part. We get to hear where your minds are and how you've reacted and responded to this. We also have some questions coming in on Twitter, so I'm going to feed them in. And we're going to play that wonderful game, whereas if you volunteer to take a question as panelists, you get to choose. But if you don't, you'll be left to answer whatever is the last question. So be brave. And now, in asking a question, the time-honored tradition... please actually ask a question, and ask one question. As an NGO person, I know what a three-chapter advocacy statement sounds like. Okay, so adhere to that. If you could say your name, put your hand in the air, and if you work for an organization you think that's relevant, please let us know. And let's start, and we have two mics in the room. So we have one mic here, and we have a... So let's start here, and then here, and we'll come back over there. So we're going to start right here, yeah, front, and then we're going to go...
Okay, Cinnamon Dornsife, Johns Hopkins SAIS. A shout out to George and Catherine and others. This is really interesting. It's my one question. And this, I think, is for Joel. Why don't we add why to the performance component? Because we talk about where, who, and how, but why not why? And I think we've talked about that a little bit more, but I'd like to hear your answer.
He said that to me yesterday, so I know he's got a view on that. We've got
Michael Jarvis with Transparency and Accountability Initiative, which is a donor collaborative, five of whose members are private funders, DFID being the other. And I'm pleased to say several of our members do publish to IATI even as private funders. But it did raise questions internally, and this is the question piece on fit for purpose and the fact that they're reporting to other platforms. And I think the real motivator that Tessie highlighted is use. And I would welcome the panelists' thoughts on how you can actually have encouragement within your own organizations, not just to publish, but to do your own tracking of use and actually acting upon any feedback that come that way. Because I think you have a responsibility as a publisher, not just to publish, but to actually reflect on what people do with that data, how they interact with it, and what it tells you as an institution that you can do better with. And for I publish what you fund, to have a comparable set of data on usage as well as the metrics of the performance in the index, I think would be a really useful layer.
That's Thanks. Great. Thanks, Michael. And I know you to be such a wily advocate that you not only asked the question in the room, but you got on as Reed M. Porter and asked, what's the responsibility of publishers to have to ensure data is not just useful, but used? Please answer that question too. So, well played. Or if Reed Porter is a different person, we're very glad to answer your question. Okay, and here. Is he here, Reed? Okay, thank you, Reed.
Renata Harlan, European Union delegation. The booklet you got was funded by the European Union, the European Union institutions, and DFID from the UK. So we are very committed to the initiative. I have two questions. The one is also input and use. That is a question that is not only for the panel, but perhaps also to our representative on publish what you fund. Do you have any evidence how this is being used by the different organizations that have access to it? The other question is, if OPIC is among the U.S. institutions that report to publish what you fund, is the front runner, what is happening amongst you and the other entities like USAID and MCC to enhance the overall score in terms of mutual learning? We are organizing as EU such a learning exercise next week in Brussels. Then I need to do one or two comments.
Oh, no, no. Just I need, one comment, please.
Okay. The comment on the low score of United Arab Emirates and China.
Yeah.
I think it's great that they are part. I mean, years ago, it has taken a long time to get them on.
Yeah.
Of course, they start with a low score. Give them a chance.
Great, thank you. If others would like to, that can be put in the form of a question. Is it a good or a bad thing that China is choosing to engage in this and is ranking rock bottom? One last question I'd like to put in the mix too, and perhaps it is for both of you, but it was addressed to you, Aaron. Aaron, what's your view from inside IFC about the behavior of employees in creating a culture of more transparency? And what's still pending to do in practice? And I think that's just as applicable to OPIC. So it'd be great to get your views. And Tessie and Joel, I mean, the use question, I think would be really, that came up in a number of different elements. If either or both of you could speak to that too from your both long-term development and humanitarian perspectives. So who'd like to start? And I'll make sure that we cover all of it. Katie, do you want to get going?
Yeah. So I'll speak to the culture at OPIC and how we feel about transparency, I think. And, you know, I've been at this institution for months, not years. Most people at OPIC have been there because it's consistently ranked one of the best places to work in the U.S. government for like 20 years. And I have to say, there is an unbelievable amount of dedication to best practices, as I said in my opening comments. The people that I work with on a daily basis should be making millions of dollars on Wall Street. They're investment bankers. And they're here because they care about the mission, they care about the work that they're doing, and they want to adhere to and push the rest of the world toward these best practices and transparency. So, when I was preparing for this panel, I spoke to a lot of the leadership in our organization and asked them basic questions about transparency at OPIC. And the to a person, it was, we report everything we can, and we're pushing our counterparts to be as transparent. So I see nothing but complete commitment to this and wanting to be leaders. In fact, we're signing MOUs with partner institutions that immediately call out this need for transparency. So I would say as an institution, we are at the forefront and nothing if not going to becoming more transparent as much as possible.
I'll finish then on the culture side of the questions then. I think it's been a process. Let's say there are a couple camps of people, right, internally. There are people that get it but think it's a burden. Mm. There are people that react like, oh, our clients are never going to go for this. There's the no, flat out no camp. Then there are also a group of people that recognize the benefits that transparency has in improving your own data quality, which is, I cannot underestimate, actually. Mm. When you report something, it's real, and you better be able to stand behind it.
Exactly.
And so that in and of itself makes you more efficient, makes you more analytical, which is all good. So there are people use transparency for different reasons internally, I would say. Over time, so our transparency policy, the most recent one is from 2012, and it sort of dictates our whole approach to transparency in general. And it was markedly an improvement over where we were before that. And so when we rolled that out, we thought of it in a way, what is going to help you do this? So part of it is making it easy for people. And you've got to figure, IT has a lot to do with that, but also just explaining to them, this is why we're doing it, this is how it can help you in showcasing your own work, which is important in any institution. And also, it's helpful in showcasing our clients' work. That's what it's really about.
Mm.
And so you can use that, and we also like made brochures and things for people to work with clients to explain it to them and how this policy actually can be helpful to them too. Today, most people buy into that. The amount of people in that camp is small. So no one's talking about, you know, or even questioning, what is this? Why are we doing it? They get it. They may still grumble about the process or whatever, but the amount of people that question why is far less. So I think that's a good thing.
That's great. And very honest.
One more
Thanks.
Thing on the
Please,
gender
yeah.
piece.
Yeah.
Some of the things that Aaron said struck me. I think when we were introducing 2X to OPIC, there was this like resistance to buy-in that our clients won't buy into it, and it's just going to add time and cost to transactions. And we have just pushed, and I'll use the example of the financial institution side. When we work with partner financial institutions and ask them how much of their borrowers, what percentage are women, and they come back and say, we actually don't have sex disaggregated data, as an investor, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Like, if you don't understand your customers, that's a problem. And so we've really turned it to say, let's see how this can help you become a better financial institution than us. So I'm trying to get to this, like, idea that it's in our clients' interest, and the more we can give feedback to them and make this something that they use and they benefit from and not a burden, that's really the direction that OPIC has tried to take this.
Thank you. Tessie, could you say a word about the use question to get us started? And if possible, any further reflections on the role of the U.S.? There was a reference made, I think, thoughtfully to how the different agencies are doing. Well, your own take on that, having engaged that over the last few days?
Yeah, because, in fact, I didn't answer your question last time. So on data use, well, I mean, so I'll be very candid because, you know, we're among friends. Did I, you know, when I said in my organization that we're committed to data, you know, transparency and to publishing to IATI, you know, the idea of, you know, so who the heck is going to use it and how's this going to, like, it almost, to me, it didn't matter. It was meant to be a signal and about the importance of accountability to donors and to the communities where we work, and we're very committed to, you know, sort of local ownership and community led, you know, efforts. We're not in the business of sort of delivering, you know, stuff, and so we thought that this was congruent with that. So we do it irrespective of how it's going to be used. But as I said at the very beginning, it is a bit of a slog unless we have better information about how the data that is being published is being used. And we, to the point that's been made here, we really, you know, don't know. And I also will say, I mean, sort of another bit of a, you know, frustration for me is that, you know, we're only able ourselves, so PLAN is part of a larger, you know, federated entity, and so I can publish what I have control of, sort of my side of the equation, but to do a full reporting of the whole supply chain, I need the rest of PLAN International to also be publishing to IATI, and so part of my own internal effort has been to get them to do that. They finally did commit to start doing it. I'm not quite sure what the schedule is, but it's huge because it's about the entire supply chain, and I only, you know, represent a part. So it's a work in progress. I don't have a great answer for that. On the aid question, So they've been doing, you know, better. And again, IATI is not transparency, right? It's just simply a tool. But it does reflect and an organization's, you know, improvement in the scale, as imperfect as the measurement is for everyone, right? Because not one size fits all. But it does reflect, I think, a deepening of a culture of transparency, you know, in the organization. And I do believe that at the end of the day, the tone is very much set at the top. I think you said it when you referred to your CEO, Katie, right? If the head of the organization, if the senior leadership of the organization is on board and fully committed, then it will happen. Otherwise, it really doesn't. And so I do believe, you know, certainly my own personal observation that, you know, the improvements that you see from the U.S. perspective are reflection of a deeper commitment to a culture of transparency that exists in the organization. That being said, now speaking as an implementing partner, and what does transparency look like from that perspective? Well, you know, a partner is an interesting word. We're not really we're generally not partners, and that honestly is a lost opportunity for both sides, because the work that we're generally involved in is more than complicated, right? It's complex, and if we are not in a real partnership, and I would say when we compare how we work with USAID and we compare that with how we work with other institutions, it's not the same type of partnership at all. And that is a giant lost opportunity, because we're not getting the best out of each other. And that is, I think, leading to not producing the best possible outcomes we can for the communities in which we work.
Thanks, Tessie. So we have about five. This is going to be the last round of reflections. I'm going to ask Joel to offer a reflection on that why question, which was really interesting. But if you could also, any last comment you want to make in closing this off, and I'll give the mic over to George in about 5 minutes. I do have two other questions I'm going to bring into the room for others to be thinking about as well. So for either Aaron or Katie, here's an interesting one. From Diana Albaum, our good friend, are there any plans to expand aid transparency to include or link with contract transparency? Do panelists think this would be helpful? And I just want a little plug. In a few hours, Oxfam will be launching its contract disclosure survey and making public. If it's true, as both Katie and Aaron have said, that the big money is being crowded in from private investment, how do we use transparency around contract disclosure to get them to see their own role in this? So any other comments that you have in that respect? And Tessie, in your final comment, or Joel, we had a wonderful question from Kenya, from Winnie Kamau there, who's the head of the Association of Freelance Journalists. Journalists in Kenya, and I think this is true elsewhere, need timely and accessible information to write the stories and inform the citizens in the country on development work being carried out by international NGOs. It's hard at the moment to see who's been mandated to do this work. What kind of steps do organizations like yours need to be doing to make it easier for local activists to hold institutions accountable? So if you could stick a sentence about that in and take us home. And I'm sorry to those of you who've waited patiently, because I see still one or two more hands. Unless these guys are unimaginably crisp, I may not be able to get to you.
Chris. Who do you want to start?
I'm going to ask Joel to say something on the why, then I'm going to let you two volunteer, and we'll go to Tessie to close, and then over to George. Yeah.
Why gets you into politics? Why gets you into ideology? Why gets you into the tough questions about core decisions that you make as to where you're going to work? And in the humanitarian sector, almost every single agency is, when pressed, will always hide behind the humanitarian principles of humanity, you know, impartiality, independence, and neutrality. But we need to be challenged. We need to be deconstructed. I mean, I'll brag about the Norwegian Refugee Council. In Syria, we are working in Damascus. We are working in northeast and eastern Syria. We are working cross-border from the neighboring countries, and we're working with refugees. And the reason we're able to do that, I'll also brag about my boss, is we have in our Secretary General, Jan Egeland, one of the leading humanitarian leaders in the entire world, who was able to go in and basically negotiate access inside Syria that no one else was able to negotiate. The why is a true commitment to reaching vulnerable people in Syria wherever they are found. Others may have an approach that says, we're in the anti-Assad camp, and we're going to take tons of money to work with the opposition in northern Syria. And under the circumstances, I think that's a totally understandable decision. But you see, the minute you get into the why, you're into politics. You're into ideology. You're into the tough decisions that we have to make around reaching vulnerable people. So I think to throw the why into IATI or into this transparency initiative would be unbelievably challenging.
Thanks. Contract disclosure, sure. You want to volunteer?
I'll take that one, sure. Yeah. Very important and growing. I would say look at what we did with the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, and Oxfam was a great partner in that. I would say in any case now where you have increasingly a government-private role, contracts are extremely important because there's a give and take there, right? And the EITI has been particularly a great benchmark for that. And I think now most companies look at that. That's actually beneficial for them, right? They want to prove where the money flow is going. Mm. And so what was once a burden is now today actually a benefit. Mm. So take that forward. Look at what we're trying to do now in the PPP space, public-private partnership space, where in many cases projects we're financing have a government and a private component. Across bank group department or whatever you want to call it, is working on creating model contracts and guidelines for contract transparency that we then hope to, you know, have all our clients apply. So it's important and it's growing, and I think, you know, we'd like to see maybe this is something we can incorporate into IATI in the future as well.
That's great, and thanks for the push. Mm-hmm. Katie, a closing reflection from you on that? In that regard, or on any issue that you want to take away?
Thank you for having me. This was fantastic. I don't have anything to add right now.
Okay.
Sorry.
If you have another, that's great. Yeah. So, and Tessie, in particular, our Kenyan friend who asks, you know, are we committed to giving them the information that they need to be able to hold their own institutions accountable? Do we need to be?
So, yeah, I mean, of course. And that's why I say that, you know, sort of it's not for me the commitment to publish to IATI is not the end of a be all. But I think that civil society organizations like PLAN do have a responsibility to also be providing that information. And going further than that, because data alone is not it, I mean, we do have to be working on the access and the advocacy side of it. So the answer is yes, we all need to make that commitment.
Thanks. George, I'm about to hand over to you, but before I do, I just want to say I've done a few of these over the years. I thought this was a thoughtful, courageous, insightful, creative panel who brought a lot of great ideas into the room. So please give them a round of applause.
It was our moderator.
George. Thanks, guys. You were great. George.
To very briefly wrap this up, Catherine, I think in spite of all the progress, this has not been a rah-rah session. And that's great. And we've identified some of the challenges. Tessie, you've talked about the difficulty of getting an organization to take on the transparency. Aaron and Joel, you've talked about how humanitarian and development finance, IATI's systems don't really fit and need to be adjusted in order to get you. Paul and Diana, wherever you are, brought in the contracts and the need to get transparency into the contracts. I take away the several of you said the technical solutions are easy. It's the political will that's so important. I'm impressed with all of your commitment. Kathy, I think all of us leave wanting to know more about 2X and being impressed with OPIC's commitment to gender and women. Mm. Paul, you said before we came in here, is if all we do is talk about something that we can read about and we all know about, it's not going to be a successful day. You have led this panel to be very frank and open and honest and identify some of the challenges out there. So thank you, and thank all of you for a wonderful discussion.
Thanks. Thank you. Damn.